So first and foremost, I want to thank all of you guys for coming out today for the second day of Free Thought Festival 9. We will now be hearing from Mr. Matthew Fasciani, who is speaking about how to discuss controversial scientific topics. So Matthew Fasciani is a sociology PhD student, activist, and science communicator. In addition, he is a blogger and podcaster known for discussing science and scientists alike. Give it up for Matthew.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for inviting me. I just want to thank the organizers for taking time to put this all together. And thank you all for staying to the very end to listen to my talk. I appreciate it. So today I'm going to be talking about how do we talk about controversial scientific topics. But I think a lot of this would apply to any type of information that people may find personally threatening to their identity. So political, religious, those kinds of identities, I think, operate in a similar psychological mechanism. But for this talk, I'll be focusing more on scientific topics. So I'm going to start off talking about why people reject science, some of the psychology, sociology research on that, what we can do about it, and I'll try to break that down into five steps that can try to summarize a lot of research and just five easy steps to try to remember. And finally, I'll end it with some personal examples of me trying to apply this research in my own life. So outreach work, activism work. And again, this isn't necessarily discussing scientific topics sometimes. Sometimes it's political issues or social issues too, because I think there's a lot of similarities as well. And I'll be talking about how I did with those examples as well, because there's varying degrees of success. So the first thing I want to say is there's some good news, and the good news is that most people do support science. So if you look at a lot of survey data, you see that the majority of people have a mostly positive view towards science, thinking that it has a positive effect on society, that it's made life easier for people, that even basic science research is valuable and pays off in the long run. Additionally, scientists are also one of the most trusted groups. So overall, when we think about Americans, generally they have pretty positive views towards science and scientists. However, there are many people who do not like certain scientific findings. And this is going into some research comparing U.S. adults, a sample of U.S. adults versus a sample of scientists, on a variety of different scientific questions. So the first one up there, it asks people, is it safe to eat genetically modified foods? And 37% of U.S. adults agree with that, compared to 88% of scientists. That's a pretty big gap. Another one, talking about evolution. So 65% of U.S. adults thinks that humans have evolved over time, compared to 98% of scientists. And another one I'll highlight here, climate change. About 50% of Americans think that climate change is mostly due to human activity. And this is contrasted with 87% of a group of scientists. This is all types of scientists, not just geologists and people in those fields. But you can see some pretty stark contrast here. So one idea is that this is an education problem, that if only we just had more education, this could help. And even scientists think this too, that a major reason is that there's not enough science education in K-12. However, this is not actually true. So when we look at the data a little bit more closely, we see that education's not enough. And there's this idea called the deficit model, that there's this deficit of knowledge, and if we just fill that deficit, people will accept the evidence. But as I'll show you, it helps somewhat, but it's only part of the solution. Importantly, even highly educated people can get science wrong, especially when it conflicts with their ideologies. So, I'll now talk about how ideologies create bias. And again, going on a couple of pretty salient examples, whenever we think about climate change, as far as the Earth warming, you see a pretty stark contrast between Democrats and Republicans. So these are all U.S. adults, but they answer this question very differently depending on their political ideology. You can see 27% of Republicans think that the Earth is warming due to mostly human activity, contrasted with Democrats 71%. Again, with evolution, we see a pretty stark contrast as well, which is due to religion, where you see that only about 33% of all adults think that humans have existed from the present form since the beginning of time. But when you look at all the breakdown of types of religions, you see that evangelicals really drive this effect. And there's a much more likely to believe this if you're an evangelical Christian. So to take this even a step further, when we look at intelligence and education, we still see this effect arise. So this graph shows a group of below average religiosity people in blue contrasted against above average religiosity people in orange. And they took this test, an ordinary science intelligence test, asking a bunch of different questions like parts of the atom and general 101 stuff that you would find in college classes. And as you can see, even people that did really well on the ordinary science intelligence, so they scored really high on this overall test, they still answer this question incorrectly, that human beings as we know them today developed from earlier species of animals. So asking if evolution is true or false. The answer here is true, but even though people would score generally pretty high on this intelligence test, they still wouldn't be any more likely to answer it correctly. This is contrasted against people with less religiosity. As they had higher degrees of science intelligence, they're more likely to say that's true. Now, what's interesting is that whenever you add just the few words according to the theory of evolution, there's really no difference anymore because this is no longer threatening their ideology. Yes?
What's the scale and bottom?
This is a measure of science intelligence.
What's the unit?
The unit?
Standard deviations, what is 1 through 25?
So it's an average of how well they did. I think it is standard deviations, but I can send you the paper if you're interested. I think it's standard deviations. It's a test that they developed themselves. And that's like an average, so yeah, I think standard deviations is what it is. But yeah, I forget exactly all the questions they asked. I think part of the atom and stuff like that. So yeah, you can see how once you add these few words at the beginning, the effect actually goes away, which is interesting. So related to that is climate change and science intelligence. So again, same type of program here where we had this ordinary science intelligence scale. So yeah, it was like standard deviations, percentiles, that's the x-axis there. But for this one, it's looking at the risk of global warming. And if people think that there's a higher risk of global warming, depending on how well they score on this test. And for Democrats, you can see this nice little increase as they get higher on this scale. They're more likely to say that global warming is an extremely high risk. But with conservatives, there's really no difference. So even though they score really high, even the 99th percentile, there's still not going to be a big difference on answering the amount of risk for global warming. So this research shows that education doesn't necessarily mean that people are just going to accept these controversial issues. And this is because identities shape our beliefs. So what I mean by identity is just something that provides meaning for navigating the social world. And this can be a political or religious identity, such as Democrat, Republican, Christian, but also it can be anything in our day-to-day lives, such as like being a parent or a student, a presenter, audience member, anything that kind of shows us what are the specific social roles that are appropriate. But whenever it's attached to a certain belief system, adhering to those certain beliefs associated with the identity is what people are motivated to do. And they're especially motivated to do this whenever it's activated in their mind. So the more salient it is in their mind, the more likely they are to want to achieve consistency between the beliefs and their actions related to that identity. For example, this study looked at conservatives and had two groups of conservatives. One group, they had them think about their conservatism, so they wrote a little essay about what conservatism means to them. And the other one, they had just a neutral task. And they found that when people thought about being a conservative and then asked them about their beliefs about climate change, they were more likely to disagree with climate change being man-made. So just reflecting on your conservative ideology kind of polarizes you. Additionally, there's been some research looking at how conservatives pay attention in a different way as far as just words flashing on the screen that are related to climate. And this is interesting because on a perceptual level, we can see this effect happening. So it's a very top-down process. Beyond identities, echo chambers can bolster this. So not just thinking about your identity, but then if you're surrounded by people who agree with you, this can increase belief polarization as well. And when we look at the types of networks people are in, we find that they're more likely to have these kinds of anti-science beliefs if they're surrounded with people who think like them. So for example, creationists have a higher likelihood of being a creationist if they're in a social network of people who are also creationists. And we also see that the most extreme partisans, so both Democrats and Republicans, when they have very politically homogeneous networks on social media, they're the most polarized. But these are just correlational, and a study tried to do an experiment to parse out the causality here, and they did find that political attitudes do become more extreme after a group discussion of like-minded people. So we do see this cause and effect of when you're around people who think like you, it can polarize you, and we can experimentally manipulate this. So one really important aspect of this process is understanding emotions. The role of emotion really plays a large role in it. And the gist of it is that when people are presented with identity-threatening information, it makes them feel insecure and uncertain. And we generally don't like feeling insecure and uncertain. So we're motivated to try to prevent doing that and feeling like that. And there's a lot of research looking at how people will double down on their beliefs whenever you make them feel uncertain first, because they get meaning from that belief system, and you can double down on this and have stronger beliefs once you're feeling more negatively about yourself first. And we see this with climate change information, for example, that if you have people that are already kind of skeptical about climate change, and then you have them have these doomsday type of messaging, like the end of the world's gonna happen, and it's this really extreme rhetoric, they're actually less likely to accept climate change as being man-made. And again, this goes in the idea that it's because it's so threatening and so extreme, our brains kind of shut down and be like, I don't want to think about it, it's too much. And they're more receptive to something that's more positive and gives us a way to change it. And this is consistent with research looking at self-affirmation, which is kind of the opposite of self-uncertainty. So instead of feeling uncertain about yourself, you feel good about yourself. And different researchers can experimentally induce this by having people write an essay about a time where they felt good about themselves before they read this threatening information. And we find that this actually makes people much more objective in processing political information. So once people write this little essay about a time where they felt good about themselves and they're feeling competent and secure in themselves, then you ask them to evaluate different political issues that may be opposite to what they typically think, and they're less polarized. It doesn't necessarily mean that they totally flip their positions, but they're less extreme. And this is true even with health information. So you can have people who, for example, let's say that you have a group of coffee drinkers. This was a study of people that drink a lot of coffee. And then you present them with a fake study that says coffee causes cancer. And interestingly enough, if you prime them with self-affirmation first, and then give them the information that coffee is bad for you, they're more likely to accept it as true. Because they're like, okay, well, maybe this is true, and this is something I can change in my diet. But without that, people are less likely to accept something as drastic. And we see this in a lot of different examples. Smoking ads, for example, whenever it's really extreme, kind of doesn't work as well. Same with safe sex practices. If you just focus on STDs instead of having a more complex discussion of healthy sexuality, if people are less likely to practice safe sex. So just throwing really extreme messaging at people often backfires. So important to think about how people are feeling. Don't want them to be sad. We want to try to make them feel good about before they have some sort of negative exposure to this identity-threatening information. So that was just a super brief overview of some of the research on here. But the next part is I'm going to try to distill this into 5 steps. That I think can be helpful whenever we try to discuss controversial scientific topics, or again, any kind of topic that we might think someone might be upset about or it would threaten their personal identity. The first one is simply to leave, then listen, relate, reframe, and repeat. And I'll go into details of all these right now. So, first one, leave your bubble. So that's what I mean by leave. And what I mean by this is talking to people who disagree with you, the first step is to actually have those kinds of conversations. Because as I already talked about, these echo chambers lead the polarization. So just having a more heterogeneous network can diffuse this. But also, there's this false perception effect. So when we're only talking to people who think like us, we don't necessarily know what the other side really believes. In fact, we're actually pretty bad at it sometimes. And there's this research looking at the perception gap, and this is focused on politics. But the idea is that basically there's a variety of political beliefs in America, and a lot of people are in the middle, and then on either end you have more extreme left-wing people and more extreme right-wing people, but it's a fairly normal distribution. However, both Democrats and Republicans estimate that the other side has about 55% of them have these really extreme beliefs. In reality, those same beliefs they think they hold is only closer to about 30%. And there's a few reasons why this could be. One is the media impact. So, as we know, fake news spreads faster than real news because it's sensationalized. We can see this all over social media. In fact, there's a lot of incentive to have people stay on their computers as much as possible and click and share and have engagement. And unfortunately, this means that a lot of negative and misinformation is going to be spread about each political side. So whenever we leave our bubble and make an effort to talk with people who think differently than us, this can help reduce some of this polarization. But it gets complicated because superficial exposure isn't enough. So it's not enough to just follow someone on Twitter, for example, that thinks differently than you. In fact, this study had a group of Democrats and Republicans follow several different Twitter accounts of the opposite politics that they hold for a month. And they did a before and after polarization test of their political beliefs. And they found that after following these people who have the opposite political beliefs as they do, they became more polarized. And this is just a superficial exposure, right? People on Twitter, you're not having meaningful discourse with them oftentimes. And sometimes if you're following celebrities and people that are public figures, you might not really have much of a conversation at all. You might just see their posts. However, some of the work that I did found that whenever people have meaningful relationships with those who they have different viewpoints with, this can actually reduce polarized beliefs. So whenever we think about these types of meaningful relationships, and if there's some diversity in that network, then this actually reduces polarization. So it's not enough to just have networks of superficial contacts, people on social media you don't really know, but the people that are very central to your lives, whenever those people hold some different political beliefs as you do, this is associated with the reduced polarization. And one example that came out that I thought was interesting was how children are actually particularly effective at communicating climate change to their parents, as opposed to another group of children. So parents, whenever they're more skeptical about climate change, and if they listen to their children talk about their concerns for climate change versus another group of children, the ones closest to them actually have a stronger effect. So that's the first overall step. So leaving your bubble is important. But once you leave your bubble, this is where it takes some work, because you have to listen, but listen with compassion to the other side. And really make it an effort to understand where the other person's coming from. So resist the urge to judge. Even if we think what they believe is pretty silly, whenever we're dismissive towards them, remember the negative feelings makes people double down on their beliefs. So if we make sure that they're feeling heard, then it avoids defensive biases. And there's been a lot of research just looking at this idea of feeling and the openness of information processing. So, for example, what could be an emotional reason to be against vaccines? Anyone want to shout it out? Yeah, so concerns of health, fear, like that's a very emotional response. And if you're dismissive towards those emotional responses, then people are going to get upset. So you can try to listen and be like, yeah, I hear you. I care about my kids too. But here's, we both care about our kids. Here's what some of the evidence that I've been reading suggests. What about climate change? What's an emotional reason that someone may want to reject climate change?
Liberals are talking about it.
Yeah. So the liberals, the out-group, the scary people, they don't like it. So that's another big part of it is in-group, out-group effects.
Guilt.
And guilt, yeah. So just the idea of we're contributing to something pretty awful, that something bad's going to happen. If we work in, let's say, coal or other types of energy, that are different types of fossil fuels, if that's our job, maybe we don't want to think that our livelihood's contributing to this. So there's some pretty strong emotions that people could have towards this.
What about the flip side? Why are liberals, especially progressives, so alarmist on climate change when climate scientists themselves are not? If you look at surveys, you know, the New York Times and New Yorker, the end of the world's coming by 2100. Why? I'm curious what your response to that is.
Yeah, like I said, the alarmist messaging can have a backfire effect. And it's unfortunate. But again, when we think of the media, they have an incentive to get as many clicks as they can.
No, but why do the people who believe that, not the media, why do liberals believe this now more and more? That it's catastrophic. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, well, the science is less clear about the long-term effects. Like, we know that it's man-made, and we know that it's bad, but as far as, like, the specific year when civilization's going to collapse, that is a little bit more nebulous.
Nobody believes that. I'm a climate scientist. I don't know who I'm here, but I'm serious about this. It's about 2%. If you look at surveys of 1,800 climate scientists, and there are about three big surveys about that, almost nobody actually believes that. The media puts them on TV, James Hansen, etc. So I'm wondering, you know, this is not a true statement that society can collapse. It's just simply not. So why do liberals have this bias of, you know, I'm curious, why do they want to believe that we're going to all end, you know, in 2050, 2100, 2050, or 2150?
Yeah, like I said, so there's still sensationalization on both sides. Like either the outright dismissal or thinking that it's going to happen much sooner and having certainty with that. So the certainty is something that, as far as like, again, the collapse of civilization, there's a bunch of different figures on when that's gonna happen, right? But.
No, wrong, sorry.
Okay. Yeah, we could talk about it later though.
I just said right, nobody says this, almost nobody.
Well, we have to delineate what do you mean specifically, but we could talk about it later. Yeah, but yeah, thank you for sharing. So it's important to think about how these identities provide a community and sense of meaning. So another example of more anti-science beliefs are flat earthers. And this is something that a lot of scientists have overwhelmingly shown to not be true, that the earth is not flat. And a really great documentary is actually called Beyond the Curve. Has anyone watched this, heard of it? Yeah? I thought it was pretty good. So they really dive into the community of the flat earthers and how much meaning people get from the social community. So when you think about it, it's like, okay, they have this belief that conflicts with science, but if all of their close friends believe this and they have this strong social network, it can be pretty threatening to think about that their whole network is going to leave them as soon as they change their mind. Similarly to religion, right? So if you're a very religious person, you have a religious community, and you're having a discussion about religiosity, it can be really scary to think about, well, if I come out as an atheist, I might lose a lot of friends. So that's a very strong emotional incentive to reject evidence. But I really like this documentary because they dive into this process of how the community is so important and emotions are very important with people upholding these beliefs. So I really recommend it. It's a good one. Next, relate to them. So we're having this discussion, we're leaving our bubbles, and one way we can relate to people is simply sharing a in-group identity. So if you have two different groups of people that may have very different beliefs, one way to reduce division is to focus on something you have in common and go from there. Because people are much more sympathetic to those within the same group than when someone's clearly an out-group member. Because as soon as someone's seen as an out-group member, you just shut down, you don't want to listen to them, unfortunately. And some interesting research shows that Democrats and Republicans become less politically biased when they're first asked to think about their American identity and how they're all Americans, they're all trying to do their best, and this actually can reduce some political bias. And there's a lot of social psychological research on focusing on an in-group first that both people have, and then building from that, as opposed to starting from out-groups. So a friend of mine, Ray McTufi, has this empathy workshop that really dives into this. And she talks about how we should try to be engaging and not dismissive of people who hold different viewpoints. And her workshop actually has a lot of role-playing when you're forced to try to think of the other perspective. And in doing this, it becomes easier to actually try to listen to what they're hearing. And there's been even more recent research looking at something called deep listening, where, again, it's very similar, where you're forced to listen to the other perspective. And it finds out, if we find out that it does reduce polarization. So once the incentive structure is set and people feel comfortable in this space having these conversations, we can see a reduced depolarization. So you can think about different things you have in common. So maybe you don't have religion in common, you don't have fishing in common, but you both have children. This is something you can focus on and try to share that in-group identity and then talk about the things you may disagree with. There's also a climate scientist, Dr. Catherine Hayo, who talks with conservatives, but relates to them with religion. So she talks about how conservation is conservative in itself, and we should try to conserve things and try to reduce our impact on the Earth with global emissions. But she also has some interesting theological arguments for taking care of the Earth, and she speaks of it in those terms. Because she's a Christian, she can talk to conservative Christians and have this shared in-group identity, so maybe they're less on board with climate change, but they can both talk about Christianity and how that's important for them. So it's an in-route to having a positive discussion. So once we're having these conversations, it's also important to think about reframing it. So you're having a discussion with someone, you can try to think about, well, what are their values? Maybe they're different than ours. There's been some research looking at how liberals and conservatives have very different values. For example, liberals tend to value fairness and reducing harm very strongly, and conservatives do as well, but liberals do it even more strongly. Whereas conservatives value purity, loyalty, and liberty. This is the moral foundations research. And generally we find this with liberals and conservatives, although some recent research shows it gets a little bit more complicated. But that's the general idea. So some research looked at how conservatives are going to be more supportive of pro-environmental legislation when framed in terms of purity than harm. So again, using alarmist messaging can turn a lot of conservatives off. But if you talk about conserving resources and protecting the earth, protecting the country, they're more receptive. Additionally, liberals will actually be more supportive of military spending when we talk about how the military can help poor people in our country as far as giving them college education and resources and so forth. So this helps with fairness and reducing harm, and if you put it in those terms, then liberals will be more supportive of military spending when they're not typically as much. So once you're having this conversation, some specifics you can use to try to reduce polarization can simply be to ask for detailed explanations of why people think like this. So oftentimes, there's this, we have this binary thinking of this is wrong and this is right. Whereas a lot of times, the truth is somewhere in the middle. So if you ask someone, how does this work? It makes them reflect on their beliefs and really think about how confident they are. So you can ask them these questions, like what's the mechanism of why you believe the earth is flat or why you think vaccines cause autism, and really ask them to spell it out for you. And again, this is later on in the conversation. If you start off with these types of questions, it may be seen as create defensiveness and be seen as an attack. But later on, I've found that people are receptive to trying to answer these types of questions. And sometimes they'll be like, well, maybe I'm not as confident as I thought I was. But this is after you build a meaningful relationship. Yes?
Yeah, a couple things that I run into is just being too tired to have to explain yourself all the time to people. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. you go through the effort or you just skip it and say, I assume it's better always to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm going to go into next, is the emotional work it requires, and that's a big question for sure. So, you're having this conversation, and another thing that can be helpful is to give an alternative explanation of why you disagree. So if you just say you're wrong, it's not enough for people to change their mind. You have to give some alternative that's plausible and makes sense. And this, again, takes work to really have those meaningful conversations. But you don't want to leave people hanging. So you can't just be like, you're wrong. You know, the research you read about vaccines is wrong. The earth is round. You have to try to break it down for them, or else they'll more quickly revert to what they previously believed. So the last part is the simplest, but probably most important, as we just talked about, trying to repeat it. So a single conversation is unlikely to change anyone's mind, especially online, social media. I mean, there's so much discourse with people debating all kinds of topics, and it's so unlikely to actually make someone reflect on their beliefs and change their mind, because we all know, you have this wall of text instead of a human connection. But even if you have a human conversation with someone, only a single conversation, you don't have that meaningful relationship where people trust you and want to listen to you. So it does take time and energy, and it can be exhausting, and not everyone wants to do this, and that's okay. But as far as the psychological research on trying to change someone's mind and making them more open to scientific evidence or even a different social issue, this requires repeating conversations that are difficult and require a lot of emotional work, but eventually we can see some progress. So, the last part of my talk, I will give some personal examples of when I tried to implement these 5 steps with different people. And again, this isn't necessarily scientific issues. Sometimes it's just social issues or political issues. But I thought they were interesting because they're all pretty different from each other. So I'll talk about what I did, what was the outcome, how did I do? Did either of us change our mind on anything? The first one I want to talk about is a discussion I've been having with my friend Michael. So Michael and I have very different politics. I'm more on the left, he's more on the right. But we've been having this conversation on this website called Letter. It's called letter.com, which is a social media platform that emphasizes discourse between people who disagree and having thoughtful dialogue to reduce polarization. So we have had this conversation, we've been friends for a while and we talk on the phone, we text about politics quite often, but it's cool that there's actually this website to kind of document our conversation that you can look up. So we've been talking about all kinds of things as far as just social issues of Republicans versus Democrats. And throughout this discussion, it's been very productive and enlightening for me and for Michael, as he's told me. And we have both have reduced the polarization that we might have had from at the beginning. So even though I'm very left-wing in my politics, talking to Michael forces me to reflect on my own biases that I may have, For example, there's certain social programs that we look at the evaluation of how efficient or productive they are. And maybe resources can be better spent whenever we have a very specific way of testing them, which is sometimes isn't always talked about as far as people on the left. Because if you're talking with people that are just like, yeah, like, let's have more social programs, but from a more conservative viewpoint, they're going to be pushing you on trying to measure if those are actually having a meaningful impact. And also as far as government, so big government versus small government, my friend Michael is also more of a libertarian, and he challenges me on my views of government and if that's more effective or less effective. And I have to admit, with the current administration, it does make me pause on how much power and influence we want to give the presidency. So it's been going both ways, and it's been a productive conversation that's ongoing. So again, there's some depolarization from both sides, which has been cool to see. And another thing that we've bonded over originally was writing fiction. So Michael writes books, novels, and I'm trying to write a novel very slowly. And we talk about that. So that's kind of a common interest we have beyond politics. And this has taken time. I mean, it's been going on for years. And sometimes it's non-linear. So sometimes you can think that, oh, you're changing someone's mind, and then they might revert back to something where you thought that they changed their mind previously. But over time, you can see this depolarization happen. And I like this example because I think it's a pretty, something that can be a very common example as far as just talking to people you disagree with and what it looks like. And overall, I'm thankful that Michael is so receptive and kind to our discussions, so that really helps too. But we've developed this relationship and it's been really productive, and I'm thankful for it. So to evaluate how this is going with Michael, I left my bubble, I talked to someone who I disagree with on politics, I listened to his perspective, we tried to relate for some things we had in common, and as far as talking about reframing things, whenever we have some disagreements, sometimes we've had discussions on liberty, which is, again, a very libertarian perspective to emphasize that more, so I can reframe some of my arguments in that, where Michael may be more receptive to it. And I'm sure he's done the same thing with me, too. And again, we've been repeating this. So this is something I think that's been a productive conversation. I've done all the steps, and it's been a positive experience. And again, this is social and political issues, but I think the same mechanism would occur if Michael had different, more anti-science beliefs, for example. So this is going to be, these five steps I think are important for any kind of discussion where people may disagree with you, to just reduce polarization through mutual understanding. All right, so going into a very different realm, another attempt I had to reduce anti-science beliefs was when I was providing scientific testimony in South Carolina. So I used to be a neuroscientist, and I thought in my naive youth that I could just go and provide this scientific testimony to some legislators and it would change their mind. So basically the background was there was this South Carolina bill that would ban abortions at 20 weeks. You might have heard this. This is when it was first coming out a few years ago. It's been across a bunch of different states now, unfortunately. The bill claimed that fetuses could feel pain at 20 weeks neurologically, but this is just not true. There's no research on this. In fact, the research is the opposite, that it's pretty convincing that they do not feel pain. So I go in there and I present testimony to the senators, and I give them all these articles. And I thought, well, you know, I told them to their faces, this bill is foundationally flawed. It's not scientific. It shouldn't be passed because it's anti-science. And the results were pretty partisan. The Republicans, who are pro-life, were very dismissive of me. The one guy actually said, I remember I give him all these citations, and he's like, oh, that was very impressive testimony, but have you ever seen the documentary The Silent Scream? Which, if you're familiar with that, it's a propaganda documentary that's not scientific at all. But he was equating the scientific articles that I handed him to this documentary, which is pretty concerning to say the least. Democrats were more receptive, again, by party lines. the same guy that asked me about that silent scream comment, there is an abortion doctor that testified after me. He asked the abortion doctor if, while performing an abortion, does the baby ever try to run away? So again, pretty concerning. These are the people writing the laws, and they're clueless. But when we think about it, you know, that's their incentive. Like, that's the political incentive to ignore evidence and support the people that voted them in the office. So it was frustrating. I did this a few times. I met with politicians, both formally and informally. And, you know, I wasn't the only one doing this. There was lots of different activist groups trying to fight against this bill because it's really harmful. Not only is it anti-scientific, what we find is that the people who seek out abortions at 20 weeks are mostly people who are most marginalized. So poor women, women who are trying to leave an abusive relationship, you know, a lot of health, complicated health issues. And it's a very small percentage of people that seek out these abortions this late in the term. So by taking this away from them just really hurts people that are already struggling. So unfortunately, the bill ultimately was passed after a couple years. And it was delayed somewhat from some work of progressive activists in the state, but unfortunately it did end up passing. So to evaluate how I did, you know, I left my bubble, I talked to these Republican politicians, but did we have any dialogue? You know, not really. I presented it very formally. There really wasn't any sort of meaningful connection, which would be required for them to actually change their mind, plus all the political institutions of why they would not want to change their mind. The last example, again, a pretty different example here. So another thing that I did was volunteer at a rape crisis center. And sometimes I would be asked to talk to different groups of people. And one group of people I was frequently asked to talk with were fraternity men. The reason I was asked to do this wasn't because I'm better at talking about consent than any of the other workers at the organization. It was simply because I'm a guy. And as a male, talking to other men about sexual assault and consent and healthy relationships, there's less of that defensive bias than when a woman's talking about the same issues. So that's why they asked me. You can see that's me up there and all these fraternity guys, about 300 of them, I think. My friend Patrick was also there. And we both talked about consent, healthy relationships, drinking culture, bystander intervention. And we tried to have them understand that this is a real problem, especially in Greek life. So it's scary enough in the college setting, but especially in Greek life, this is unfortunately very prevalent. So I talked about statistics with all this. There was some evidence that I was trying to convey to them. So how did it go? Well, again, I talked to them as a peer, and the audience was actually pretty receptive towards me. And several of the men stayed back to talk with me afterwards and volunteer with the Rape Crisis Organization. So that was really cool to see. I think what also helped was not only did I talk with them, but the president of the fraternities also gave a little speech about how this is important and how we want to make an effort to be better in this area. So whenever I think about evaluation, I left my bubble, so I'm not a Greek life member, I actually never was one. But again, I was just speaking as a presentation style. I actually wasn't having a lot of dialogue with these fraternity men. But I did try to relate to them as a young man at that time. And I tried to reframe it as far as fraternity values. And again, it was helpful that the president of the fraternity translated this for me. I think that also helped. Did I repeat this? Unfortunately, no. So I just talked to a lot of incoming fraternity men before they joined the fraternity. But after that, you know, we weren't having an ongoing conversation. So there was some mixed results here, but to give you another example of what it can be like to talk with people who may have an incentive to not want to listen to what you have to say. So before I end this talk, I want to give a few important caveats of this whole discussion. So the first thing I want to talk about is this quote by Dylan Moran, who is a LGBTQ activist, and he talks with a lot of people who are anti-LGBTQ. And this is very difficult. He has some very difficult conversations. But one quote I really like from him is, empathy is not endorsement. So he talks with these people who hold very different beliefs than he does, and some very harmful beliefs. But he tries to connect with them and have a lot of empathy. And he's found that people do eventually lose some of these negative views they have towards LGBTQ people. And again, this requires a lot of work. It's very difficult. But I definitely would recommend checking out some of his talks. I believe he has a few different TED Talks that dive into this issue. But another thing I want to talk about is that there's other ways to enact social change. So this is very difficult work. And if you don't want to go and talk with people who disagree with you, especially if you belong to a marginalized group, sometimes it's really hard to talk with people who think that you shouldn't have human rights, for example. So I would never say that people have to do this or that it's a prescriptive method. But it is one way that can be effective if people want to put in a lot of emotional work to do so. But there's other options, such as galvanizing your own group, supporting your own group members, and making them feel excited to go out and promote social change and supporting each other. But if we want to try and persuade people and change their minds, it does require a lot of emotional work. In conclusion, people reject science because it's threatening to them. It's not because they lack education or because they're less intelligent. It's because there's a psychological incentive to avoid information that people find threatening and challenging and just provides negative emotions towards them. Our brains don't like negative emotions and stress. And if our brains can avoid processing things like that, they will. So in order to reduce that defensive bias that can happen, connecting with people on an emotional level can be very powerful. Empathy and respect go a long way, and I think are required for any sort of meaningful conversation to change people's minds, whether that's scientific information and issues, or political and social issues. So just to recap, these are my 5 steps. So leave your bubble, listen to people, relate to them, reframe the conversation, and repeat, and try to just have a meaningful, empathetic, and kind conversation with people, even if you strongly disagree with some of their beliefs, because we're all human, we're all trying our best, and if we reach out with empathy and compassion, it can be very effective. So thank you all so much. I just want to throw a picture of Bill Nye on there, because that's kind of the theme of the talk, was very science-oriented. Feel free to reach out to me on Twitter, my website. Happy to talk about this stuff at any time in the future. Thank you.
One of the things that I would recommend is between 4 and 5 is to give positive feedback to the other party in terms of the engagement that we've had, to be able to find anything positive from their end that you show appreciation of, and on a positive, always a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime you can try to cement that relationship, I think that's really powerful. There's also this workshop called Better Angels. Has anyone ever heard of that? It's like a new organization. I think they just changed the name to Braver Angels, actually. But the idea is you get Democrats and Republicans in the same room, and you have them talk with each other. And a lot of it is affirming each other, too, and trying to listen to the viewpoint. And again, it's hard if it's a short workshop or a brief interaction. But if you want to change people's minds again, putting in that work, making them feel heard, and relating to them with compassion is necessary. Yes?
Have you looked into street epistemology at all? And if you have you gotten anything there that you've been able to translate over into this?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it a little bit. My background's not so much in the philosophy, it's more psychology, social psychology. I think there's some overlap from what I've read as far as reframing it and trying to hear their perspective, asking for them. I think there's some discussion about talking about the mechanism that people present their beliefs and how confident they are, I think, right? Like, talks about like reducing dichotomization and stuff like that.
That's part of it also, is like trying to do an end around the backfire back to work. We put up walls whenever we are presented with something that is something that we hold dear. And the idea is to look at how they came to those conclusions instead of saying, oh, you're wrong because here's the science that says you're wrong, says, oh, well, how did you actually come to the conclusion that you hold that? And that is a lot better at allowing them to let go of that idea than going directly at it.
Yeah, for sure. So anytime you can get people to think about how and why instead of just what they believe, that's certainly going to be more effective. Unfortunately, sometimes that's still viewed as an attack, right? If you ask someone, explain why you believe this. And that's where some of the emotions comes in and having those meaningful relationships. So I think a lot of that would be really useful maybe like once the relationship's developed a little bit more. I think if you start trying to do those kinds of philosophical techniques right from the get-go, they may not be as effective. That would be kind of my thoughts on it.
There's Anthony Magnabosco is a YouTuber. There's several other people, and they have these videos of people just like cold, like, you know, find someone and talk and ask them about something they hold deeply.
Yeah.
It's amazing how well they can navigate the conversation and not get them to be angry or defensive if you do it well.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, I've looked at it a little bit. I'll have to read more about that. Thank you for sharing. Any other questions? Yeah.
I disagree with the conclusion that you said the problem is not a lack of education. Mm-hmm. I think it is at times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I see this again on the right and left. We discuss climate change. Mm-hmm. And my friends on the left ask me why I have right-wing views of climate change, which I don't at all. And then I press a little bit. And I realize they haven't read anything on climate change. And these are PhDs, like my brother, in economics. You know, he doesn't read science at all. I think this is true on the right as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, you don't think it's a lack of education that people need?
I would downplay it. I wouldn't say that it's not at all. Education is definitely important. But as I showed, people are going to be motivated to interpret that information in ways that confirm their biases. And there's a lot of research that I didn't show in this talk, but just if you share data with people, give them the information, and if they're on the right or the left, they're going to look at that same data very differently. And that's where it gets really fascinating to me. And I talked about a little bit with the perceptions, but I didn't want to spend too much time on it, but I think this stuff's really interesting. When you give people the same problems, like you can give them math problems to solve about gun control is another one, where it's a very simple math problem, but people will interpret the information very differently depending if they're right and left. So that's why education, it's not enough, that's what I would say. It's a good baseline, and it's obviously I'm a big advocate for education. I absolutely think people should read both sides and try to understand your opponent's position. But again, even when people do that, they're confirmation bias. They're reading it and they're skimming it, and they'd be like, oh, I don't like this part, so I'm not gonna think deeply about it. But yeah, that's education is not enough, is how I would phrase it. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's worth pointing out that white supremacists are using the method now, much like the one that you've presented today, and drawing upon our concern for the environment and the land, and they bonding with us over that. They wish to point out that immigrants are bad because they're bad for the land. So one needs to watch out, I think.
Yeah, it's important to understand how these tools can be used. Unfortunately, people will use them for evil. That's something I worry about with my research as far as persuasion, manipulation. We have to be very careful about how we implement it and how we talk about this. So it's a concern for sure. Yeah. Did you have a question? Yeah.
Yeah. Would you say education is more important for attitude formation versus persuading someone, when you're first developing an opinion?
Yeah, I think so. What do you mean by attitude formation?
I'm in an attitude psychology class right now. Mm-hmm. We talked a lot about attitude formation when you're first learning about something. And
yeah.
Trying to decide how you feel early on versus trying to change someone else's opinion, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. If I understand that, what you're saying. Whenever we first are exposed to information, it's going to shape our beliefs. So forming the initial ones, I think having a broad view of education is important. But again, once we develop these identities, we're so incentivized psychologically to process information that's consistent with our identity. And It's hard because even with education, people ignore the parts that they don't like. So as far as first exposure is very important, that's something that I've learned just talking to different groups of people. So a lot of times I talk to adults, but for example, the talks about consent, sometimes I've had more of a hostile crowd when I'm talking about these issues. And it's older people who have internalized beliefs that are different and harmful. But when I talk to kids about consent, which I did at Camp Quest one time, they got it so easily, you know, like you can ask for a hug and it's just like, okay. But you know, they're 8 years old and they haven't internalized these beliefs yet. So that's another thing to consider is like the developmental psychology part of it, of once people internalize these beliefs, it can be very hard to unlearn them, whether that's a social issue or a scientific issue. Any other questions, comments, concerns? Yeah.
I have a question. It seems, although I don't have a lot of experience outside of the United States, although I travel, it's different than having conversations with other people of other cultures. But I question whether these are general ideas across the human population, or we're talking about a culture in the United States that has devolved to a significant degree in being able to discuss anything rational at all. Could you comment on that?
So is the question, is this type of anti-science belief unique to the United States, kind of, or not being able to have these kinds of discussions? I mean, there's a lot of anti-science everywhere, and as far as not being able to have these conversations, I think, unfortunately, we see it all over the world. Political polarization is rising pretty much everywhere. The United States is particularly stark. We can see some pretty huge changes in just the past 20 years. So that's something that, you know, my focus is more on the United States since I live here. But from what I've read, this happens as far as a lack of ability to have meaningful dialogue with people you disagree with. It's a human thing, unfortunately, and we can see it all across the globe. So it's kind of a bummer, but it's important to try to be mindful of it, at least. Yeah?
So do you feel the internet has been a boon or a bane to having meaningful dialogue between people?
I think that's a complex question. It's a good question. It's kind of similar to what Lucian was talking about yesterday, about how Facebook and the internet can be so great for connecting people and getting communities, like atheists, for example. Like a lot of atheists find each other via the internet. But now, it's been weaponized against us. Have you seen the documentary, The Great Hack? That's a good one. I definitely would recommend that for anyone. Yeah, as far as just how Facebook has used the data that they've obtained to persuade people in elections. And another big interest of mine is technology and society. And I think we have to be very careful about social media and how it impacts society and makes basically everything I talked about even worse. Because these algorithms that are designed to increase engagement. And there's some nice quotes, engagement is often enragement, right? So like a lot of times when you think about the internet, people are incentivized to try to make you angry. And I just commented this the other day on my Facebook feed. So my Facebook has a lot of political discussion because it's a lot of my friends who care about politics and that's what I see. My Twitter feed is a lot of scientists and it's so different as far as just the feeling I get when I'm on each platform. But something that Twitter is trying to do is it shows you the most engaged tweets, right? So even though I'm following a lot of scientists who often tweet a lot of scientific things, whenever they like a political tweet or they reply to a political tweet, Twitter is trying to show me that more and more. So there's this problem with focusing on a lot of the worst of our psychology because it gets people to click more. And it's something I'm very worried about, and I think that it's hard to say if it's a net positive or net negative. I personally am not a fan of Facebook for a lot of reasons. I think it's pretty unethical once you dive into it. So I don't know. Both, there's pros and cons, but it's a lot of cons. Any other questions? Yeah.
Have you ever read the book, The Power of Fear by Richard Gardner?
I haven't.
I'd recommend it.
Yeah? All right, cool.
A lot of what you're talking about in that book.
Richard Gardner.
2008, so it's a little on the older side now, but it's still pretty relevant.
Okay, cool. Thanks for sharing. Yeah.
You talked a lot about, especially your friend, that sounds like you were working to bring him closer to your views, but did he bring that culture that he has?
Yeah. So I talked a little bit, but yeah, I like I said, I was more socialist, left leaning when I was talking to him, and I still pretty much am. But I'm a lot more skeptical of my beliefs and how it impacts the role of government in society. Is a lot of conversations that we have. So that's something that I'm just like, yeah, big government, it'll all be fine. And again, a more salient example has been the current administration has made me more cautious about the government having more power and more influence. So as far as trying, that's one of the coolest things about having a good conversation with someone who you disagree with, is it really forces you to know your side better. And you don't often get that when you're talking to people who all think like you, because you're just like, yeah, like liberalism, it's great. And then you talk to someone who's like, well, what about this thing? That doesn't make sense. Like whenever you try to measure the efficiency of a government program, which is another thing that we've talked about. So yeah, absolutely. I still consider myself very liberal, but I'm more cautious and more skeptical for a lot of liberal government programs and stuff like that. Anything else? All good? All right, well, thank you all so much.